here today. So when some say I'm soft spoken, so if you can't hear me, just yell and say, hey, you raise your hand, I can't hear you. But I've been looking forward to coming up and talking with you. As Holly said, I am a registered architect, a licensed architect, just like Richard. But my discussion with you is going to be a little bit different. I'm not going to talk about architecture. I'm really going to talk about the spirit or the soul of what a place should be and what it's about. And particularly the memories that I have as a child, in which I kind of grew up in Apalachicola, and I'll explain that in a minute, and how much that meant to me, and how treasured, I mean, every time I go across that bridge, and I'm coming to Apalachicola, memories start flooding in my head. So, but before I start, I want to ask a question. How many of you grew up in Apalachicola? You raise your hand. Okay. So, not as many of you there. So you probably don't know the name Rhodes, or you're probably not even familiar with some of them. But at one time, you couldn't hardly walk on the hill without bumping into a Rhodes. There are so many of them. And you'll see some of that in there. And but before I even get started again, I want to tell you that I have my wife here. His name is Sarah. Raise your hand. She's from the big town of Madison, Florida. So it's so funny because on our way up, we talked a little bit about some of the similarities. Now here, seafood industry was a big thing. There, tobacco was a big thing. She grew up picking tobacco. And so she realized that the labor of hard work and all that. But much like on the Hill, there's a lot of similarity that go on in small towns like Madison and urban areas like Orlando. So, but she did something that she normally doesn't do. She got up early on Saturday morning, 4 o'clock. And she drove me here because I was still working on the PowerPoint to try to get here. So I'm very grateful, honey. Thank you. She likes to sleep in on Saturday, so. All right. So, this here. I know I have a captive audience, and so nobody wants to sit around and watch family photos. But it's going to be very difficult for me to show or talk about the Hill and what it meant to me without showing family photos. I'm going to ask you to, you know, acknowledge that, but also look behind the people. Look at the way that place was and that neighborhood was and see where it's come and where things. So I'm going to talk a little bit about that and talk about the spirit of what it meant to me. And that's what my focus is today. Now I will share with you, because just in my brief, I came here, I got here early in the morning and talked to my relatives and some of my relatives there and friends. And so there's a lot of concern about the Hill and where it's going and what things be gone, and rightly so. So development can happen, redevelopment can occur, but it has to be the right way. Richard spoke a lot about the qualitative things that really are necessary to make a great neighborhood, not a great community or city. I'm going to talk really about the other part of that, the history and the culture that really helped sort of invigorate it, to sort of bring its soul, and so that. Now, again, I'm speaking from years ago, so all I'm going to ask you, as you move forward and develop and look at that Hill, is that you keep these things in mind. So with that, we'll go on to the next slide. So let me just start from the beginning. I am the proud product of two Apalachicolians, put it that way, Bertha Rhodes, or Bertha Croom, who's now Bertha Rhodes, and Ruffin Rhodes. So I'm the Ruffin Rhodes support. Bertha Croom, and I feel very blessed to have both sides of that family as my parents, because the Croom always speak their mind. They, you know, you talk to a Croom, they're going to tell you like it is. And as a businessman, I need that sometimes, to be able to tell just what it's like. The roadside was my, and you'll see in a minute, my great grandfather, my father were all thinkers, they're all construction type people, and that's how I got into the business I am. So that really helped me and really made me what I am. Now just a little brief story here. My father was the first child in his family on 7th Street, and which is now Dr. Frederick Humphrey Street, to go to college. He started out at Florida A&M University as a college. He was an industrial arts major. And his high school sweetheart, which was my mom, Bertha, I don't know if she called him, because I don't know if they had phones then or something, or how that, but she let him know, hey, I'm pregnant. Yeah, and it's your child. So my dad, you know, obviously he just finished his first year in college. So he comes back and he talks to his mom and dad. He says, I'm dropping out of school. And they pleaded with him not to. He says, no, this is my child. This is my wife. Or will be. I'm marrying her. And that's what he did. He took me and her to California. He joined the United States Air Force. Okay. So that shows you some of the values I asked my mom to share that, and she gave me permission to do that, because it was, you know, I had figured it out when I was a teenager. I'm 20, I already figured it out. But she kind of shared that with me. But they stay married for a little over 50 years. My father died in 2011, and I miss him dearly. I really do. It means a lot to me.
His nickname was Bud.
And so
what you see down here, that's him when they just got in California. And then he had my brother and my sister's in my mom's belly right now. So we had four children. So they're
banging them out.
That's me.
And I was born in, I think it's George Wings Hospital. And my mom said I was the first African-American baby born in that hospital. So, not that I deserve an award or anything like that.
It was just interesting to hear all that. So that's sort of my immediate family. And, of course, my father served in the military for 25 years, very proud Chief Master Sergeant.
He wanted desperately for me to get into the military. I said, no, I want to be an architect. And I've been in the military for 17 years. I've graduated high school, though. I'm going to college. And he said, okay. So, my dad loved Appalachian Cola. If he had known it, he didn't care who it was. If he had known that you'd been in Appalachian Cola, he'd have bent your ear off. He loved the town. He retired in Austin, Texas, when the base closed there, Bergson Air Force Base. And he would travel back and forth until his health deteriorated. And so he couldn't drive that. But every time I would visit him, inevitably, we end up talking about Appalachian Cola. We wanted to come back and, you know, we had owned some property and really do something with the property right there in the hill. I'll talk a little bit about that. But I'm here, you know, when Craig called me, I'm like, who is this guy? You know, he's been calling me from Orlando, this and that. And as I found more and more about what he was doing, I said, okay, I get that. I talked to Dr. Frederick Humphreys and Chauncey Ford, they're both were in Orlando at the time. They talked to me about some of the things that were going. I said, you know, I like to make this trip. If anything, just to acknowledge my dad, you know, he would want me to do it. So we'll talk about that. So my experience in Apalachicola is a little different than, say, someone else who grew up here. I grew up over a period of time. Every time my dad had a deferment, in between deferments, we were back in Apalachicola. As I was born here, two or three, when we had holidays, we were back in Apalachicola. Every chance my father had to get back here, he did. And we came, and I loved it. It was fun. I mean, and when I heard we're going to Apalachicola, we'd get all excited. You know, we're little kids, we'd dance around, we're going back to Appalachicola. Yeah. And so, to me, it was a magical place. And it was probably magical because of my family. We had extended family everywhere, as I said. And so, that is what made that special. And this is probably why I wanted to talk to you today a little bit. Now, I am an architect, and just real briefly, as Holly talked about, I own a firm
in Orlando, Florida. We're a 20-person firm. We've done a lot of buildings in Orlando. Here's the law school. We designed that. I specialize in education, K-12. So we do a lot of schools. We've worked with the Benin and Citrus Bowl. We've done that. And we do a lot of municipal-type government buildings, banquet halls. But I'm not here as an architect, as I said. I'm not here to even get work. I don't want work from any of you. I just want to tell you about the deal. And talk to you a little bit about that. So when I started, when I was born, I'm looking back about 50-odd years, thinking about what I've seen over that period of time. And so there's a period of time before that my parents and my grandparents told me about. So I'm trying to wrap a lot of that into this whole presentation. This will really kind of give you an idea as you move forward with your plans, think about some of the importance of what it means to some of these people here and all that. So this is the hill. Now, I don't mean to start any arguments here because I don't know all of where the territory is. I know that pretty much all of this area here, it may go down to 98. I don't know. You guys know it better than I do. Everyone I talk to on the phone, if you go to 12th Street or if you go to 13th Street or this or that. So this may not be accurate in totality. When I went to the property appraiser, Franklin Copper, and I clicked on a lot, it would sometimes say the hill, sometimes it would not. So I couldn't tell. But so the demographics at that time and during the time we were running was 90% black, if not more. It's probably more than that, African American. And so we're sort of looking at the time from that, the 1920s on up, and I'll tell you a little bit about that. As I said, their family was very important, just not only in my time, but in the time of my grandfather and great-grandfather, and talking about how the extended families stay together. And that's probably the same story that any of you who grew up in a town like Apalachicola, saying that people stay together, uncles, aunts, cousins. Things have changed a lot, haven't they? But that's what made that place special. People own their own businesses in those communities. And I'll show you a little bit about that in a minute. Despite segregation, many African Americans own property there. And so, again, it's just keeping those things in mind as we talk through that. So my world was this here, and it was 7th Street, and I didn't change it to Dr. Humphrey Street, it would have been too long, but and Avenue M and 12th Street. Now, that doesn't mean that I didn't go anywhere else around Apalachicola as I did, but as a child, this is pretty much most of the time I spent whenever I came to visit Apalachicola in that time span. My maternal grandparents lived on 12th Street, right at the corner. And they were Mr. Randall Kroon Sr. He worked at the paper mill in Post St. Joe. And Lily Mae Kroon, my grandmother. And so my paternal grandparents lived at 7th Street, and I believe the address is 229 7th Street. And we'll see that there. I don't know if there's even an address anymore, but that's where it was. So. I was back and forth along that street my whole life, up until even my first and second year of college, which I went to Florida A&M University, so I would come during the summers and work with my grandfather and go back to college. But I would walk down that street and go visit my other set of grandparents. And I was blessed at that time. I had two sets of grandparents that were alive. And so I got to enjoy that time span with them. So let's begin at the beginning. This is Papa Tom. He's actually Ruffin Rose I, but we call him Papa Tom. And he was actually a logger in Eufaula, Alabama. And they used to, and my grandmother told me that he would ride the log. I don't know what that meant, really. But I assumed that, there's a lake or a river as it comes down from Alabama down here into the fork,
And so I don't know if they actually rode the logs or ships dragging the log, but something like that. And over a period of time, he decided to settle in Apalachicola. And he met Emma Lou. And Emma Lou was my great-grandmother. And they got married. And part of the condition for being married was he had to build her a house. That's what her father asked him to do. So I'll show you that in a minute. So he built her a home, which that home is Mr. Creighton Brown's home right now, right there at that lot. And he got out of the logging business and got into the grocery store business. So right behind that house was a grocery store. And you've already seen it, and I'll show you more pictures of it in a little bit. So this was the first house. Now, I don't know when this picture was taken. It's got to be in either the 50s or the 60s. But this was the house. This was a store. I hope you can see that. That's my cousin right there. This is the store that was built. So he ran a grocery store. And these are my cousins, his grandkids, on their tricycles. So that it's kind of interesting. Again, notice I don't want to bore you with family pictures as much as look at the streets. Look at the buildings and the conditions of where they're at. So that's kind of what, you know, that was what we were accustomed to back then and growing into. Okay, now you probably, I remember these as a very small child. I think these are on A Street or were on A Street at one point.
Yeah.
And I can't recall where this one was. But let's talk about, you know, and Richard explained what a shotgun house or what a bungalow house is, but let's talk about what living conditions were like then, especially in the early 30s or 20s. They didn't have bathrooms, they had outhouses. You had, and so you go out there and do your business or whatever. As far as heating, you know, if you had a fireplace, it was good. Or wood stove, if you're really fortunate, or you had a kerosene heater later on, and that's where you would heat and all that. Of course, even in Apalachicola, I know it gets cold, there's no wall insulations. You had wooden floors and, tin roof, and that's what they lived in. Most of the people there worked in the seafood industry, but they had other things. So. And if you have any questions or anything, I don't mean to be just up here preaching or whatever, so certainly ask, and hopefully you can ask some questions, answer your questions. So this is my great-grandfather later on. My wife says I still dress like him. But he remained a successful businessman, and he bought property elsewhere. Rented, so he ran a store. So he's an entrepreneur. That's kind of where I get my genes, I think, because he's about running business, and you'll see. And he died, I think he died in the early, late 1970s. I remember when he died, I just can't remember the year that it was. I remember the late 1970s. He died around 92 years old, so he lived a full life. He had a blessed life and a pack full of kids.
Ruffin?
Yes.
Sorry, what were we looking at in the back?
Okay, that's his store. And when he died, my grandfather and grandmother on my father's side took over that store. And if you grew up in Apalachicola, you probably remember that store. And I can remember because I worked in there sometimes. It would, over time, they had gas pumps at one time, then they got rid of them, bread trucks would used to come, so it was really amazing, and I loved that store. Drink my knee-high, pink sodas, and everything. So.
I got a discount, too. So.
So him and Emma had 13 kids. I mean, they were busy. So. All of these are my uncles and aunts, and they all lived in town on the hill at that time. Now, later on, some of them joined the military. My Uncle Tom, or Tucker as we call it, he joined the Army. My uncle Billy joined the Army. And then my uncle Ferris Lee moved to Miami. So, but over time they started dispersing. Yes, sir.
You said your grandfather came. You fall in Alabama?
Yes.
Do you know if you still have people there?
Yes. I don't know if you remember a football coach used to coach the New York Jets, the name of Rhodes.
Ray Rhodes?
Yes. He's related to one of my great grandfather's brothers. So he's the son, grandson of one of them. So there are a few up there that are still there. So that's my claim to fame.
He doesn't know me, but I know him. So all of these individuals I knew at one time or another. This man here, Mr. Cool Daddy here with the circle on there, that's my grandfather. And I'll start talking to you a little bit about him. So all the kids worked. This young man here is my father. So, and he worked, he took care of kids, he worked for my grandfather, and he worked in this store for my great-grandfather. And so, and as they got older, and you'll see a little bit, his brothers all did the same thing in that time. And everybody worked together to survive, to take care of each other. And that's what they did, even at an early age. Transportation, they didn't have cars, you had to walk, ride a bicycle, you had a steer and a wagon, do some hauling and some things. And so this was our family steer at that time. I think someone told me the name one time, I forgot. But that's how they got around when they needed to and all that. And these were on the streets of Apalachicola at that time. So, and you know the history of Apalachicola, obviously. So, many of the Hill residents spent time in the seafood industry, shucking oysters, breaking shrimp heads. And I tried one time when I was a teenager to try that. Now, granted, this is something I had never done before. So, my friends said, come on down, let's try it. And it was a bloody mess. I didn't know those things were cutting my hands. That was only one time I tried it. That is not an easy thing to do. So that was, and they would do it fast too. It was just amazing to see them. And that's how they got paid. You got paid by the buckets and what you did. And then the mill, the lumber industry here. Well, those are one of the things that a lot of the Hill residents working on some of that and doing those type things. This is probably in the 1920s, the 30s, and the 40s. Now, they're still working in the seafood industry. I don't even know if that's still, it's been a while, so I don't know what's going on now, but I know when I was in college, there were still people breaking heads and maybe not, so. Yes, I'm not.
Where is the
lumber mill
located?
Pardon?
I'm sorry. I'm not sure where this is at. I found this on the Florida Times. I'm sorry, ma'am?
Oh, I was asking, where was the lumber mill located?
There is a mill here somewhere, right?
It was down by the mill sign. Oh, yes.
It was called Shanks Mill.
Shanks Mill.
I know all of this because I was that age when I grew up.
Yeah, that's
I know his grandfather, his father.
Tell him your name.
Chauncey Ford.
Chauncey Ford. One thing I'm really proud about my family is they had their own businesses. They had a lot of businesses. And my grandfather was a carpenter. And I can tell you stories because he went to Edward Waters College for a carpenter. Right before he got married, and so he learned how to be a carpenter there, and he started his own carpentry business. We had barbershops, a salvage yard, Chester Rhodes, you probably heard that name, had his own salvage yard, laundromat, grocery stores. We didn't own any night entertainment, but there's a lot of night entertainment going on. Green Lantern, a few, the Flat Top, some of those places that were there. So that community was, I won't say thriving, but it was, people it was an active environment. And it was busy. And things that people were making a living and people were taking care of other families. So my grandfather built a house on 7th Street, 229 7th Street, and that's where most of my family spent their time. That's my grandfather. And again, look at the streets. This house is right across from Creighton Brown's. So this was my Aunt Idell's home. She was married to, great-grandfather, Papa Tom, built that house for her. I can't remember if he built it for her or he built the property and eventually and gave it to her. But you can see the streets were this dirt. Later on, they had oyster shell, crushed oyster shell that was right in the streets. And what amazed me sometimes when I was a little kid, to see people walk across it barefoot. I tried it, and I was like, there's no way I can do that. And, you know, again, I think they kind of saw me a little as an outsider. They wasn't there all the time, but I wanted to be like everybody I saw. And so it was a tough life, and people made a living and did what they needed to do to survive. So. But my grandfather built this house, started his carpentry business, and he built homes and repaired homes all over this area. I mean, we were downtown doing some work for a dental office, I remember one time. We've been on a lot of the coastal areas repairing, building additions. That's how I got interested in construction. I can tell you that I crawled into more houses than I really care to in this town. I was always fearful of snakes. Granddad, it might be a snake out here. Get out of here, boy. I've laid tin on roofs when it's 95 degrees outside, and if you've never had to lay tin on a roof and it gets real hot, it's tough. But that's how he made his living. So I learned how to wear two pairs of pants when I'm doing that, and put gloves on when I'm doing that tin, if you get your hands cut up and all that. But I learned, I said, you know, man, I like construction. I just don't like this hard work. So, fortunately at that time, I loved to draw, and I thought to myself, you know what, I think I'm going to be an architect. Not really understanding totally what all that meant, but that's how I moved in. I'm grateful for our experience. It taught me a lot, although I will tell you, he worked his side at me, and it was tough work, and he did it up until he was 72 years old. Yeah, and he couldn't do it anymore, and that was the only reason he retired, because his body just gave out. And so, but I am grateful for the things that I learned from him and everything that he's done for me. This was my grandmother, Pearlie May, and this was his family. You've seen them. These are my uncles and aunts. This is the house on 7th Street that he built. They had five kids here, and then had two more. That's my grandmother behind them, standing there. This is them. You can see, they worked them hard. They understand the value of work, and I'm proud. This is one of my favorite photographs. And so, almost all of them are gone now, including my father. So, and this my aunt is still alive, and these two are still alive, and my aunt, my uncle, right there. Each of them had a name, and I'm going to go through all the names. A nickname. My grandfather nicknamed them a lot of different names. So, my father's name was Ruffin, but he called him Bud, and everybody knew Bud. I could walk in this town, in the hill. People would say, hey boy, you come over here. I said, yes, ma'am, I'll go walk over there. And they'll look at me. You're Rhodes, aren't you? He said, who's your dad? Bud. Oh, you Bud's boy. They would know that. I don't know how, but they knew that. So it was just amazing. So this is us sitting at the dinner table inside the house in the breakfast nook area. And that's myself, and that's my sister and brother there, and that's my aunt there. Again, I'm sorry to bore you too much with family photos. But I'm trying to paint you a picture of what life was like in there. So
And then there was school. And things were a little bit different there. So, as you probably know history, African Americans for their K-8 education went to Holy Family Church, and it was a school for black children. And so that's where they went. I actually went there for a period of time, believe it or not, even though my father was being stationed in France, and he had to leave early. So we had our family come to Apalachicola, and he had to get everything, get a house. So for 3 months, I attended the Holy Family, got my knuckles swapped a few times. But I remember the Christmas time there. I remember it was so neat being there in that family. And so that's where my father's and his family went, and a lot of the Hill kids went to Holy Family School there. All right, so then there was high school. The actual first African-American high school, I read this up, was the school board for Franklin County gave St. Paul AME Church, you probably know that church, $250 to build a school for first through ninth grade. $250 would be hardly enough to build a table these days.
Yeah.
But they did. They figured it out. They got one done. Then there was a school named Dunbar, which was on 8th Street. And if you go through the Florida archives, you'll see, I didn't want to show you too many pictures of that. And then there's Quinn. Quinn was a piece of, Quinn High School was a high school named after a white gentleman who donated 26 acres for an African American school. His name was Wallace Quinn. And because he donated that property, they built a new school. That's where the African American went. Obviously, the white children went, or the white high schoolers went to Chapman High School. So there were two separate schools. And my mom and dad, you know, I heard all these stories. In my world, that was so boring because I grew up in the military. We all went to the same school. And so hearing those stories, I was just saying, wow, that's weird. You know, you couldn't figure that out. But anyway, so Mr. Willie Speed was the principal there. And his son is here today. And he is one of everybody I talked about what a phenomenal principal he was. He made you learn. And so when I was telling my mom lives in Texas, I'm going to do this. She said, you better put that in. You better pop it. And then I saw, this is my mom in junior high school, and that's my father there. So I can see why he got in trouble. All right, so that's sort of the background of the Hill and what's going on. I'm sort of generally involved with, I hear things and I know what's going on a little bit because I'm in Orlando. Actually, there's a lot of Apalachicola residents in Orlando, by the way. In fact, and worked with Chauncey Ford, talked to Dr. Humphreys, and so people have a concern about the Hill, what's the right thing to do. And I think a lot of what Richard talked about are some things that can really help out and work for how this thing to, this sadly is my grandfather's home. And I won't get into the details of why it's like that, but if you drive around, and I did this morning, there are a lot of abandoned homes like this around me. And I understand the concern and what everybody's concerned to figure out what's the right thing to do, and where is going. I don't know that I have any answers for you. The purpose of what I'm trying to do is whatever you do, remember what you just saw. You keep those things in mind.
Excuse me?
Yes.
But is that home still in your family somewhere?
Yes, it's owned by my cousin has the deed. I'm trying to talk to her because I'd like to buy it. My father wanted to take that house and build it. He wanted it to be a place where every time family comes to visit to Apalachicola, that's where they would stay. So keep your eye. I hope I can work that out with her. because I'm able to do it. He kept getting and asking me to try to get it and before he died. So I think there might be an opportunity, we'll see. So that's what it looked like. I don't know if this is a bungalow shotgun style with a little Craftsman peel there. So, my grandfather added on to it as he built, and before he had a cesspool pool in the back. That was before he had plumbing. So he had that. And my mom or my aunt said, you know, it was so weird because those are the best. They had a plum tree, and those are the best places where to plum. But they knew not to eat them. They said they were so, they looked so good, but we were so freaky about eating those plums. So they didn't eat them there. These are things I just sort of grabbed and just made note of. I know in 1930 had a population of 3,200 people. And it seems like it's been going down since then. And I mean, I'm sure you guys know these stats. So compared from 1970 to 2010, it's like almost a 30% drop in population.
Wow.
Yeah. Now, I don't know. Some of these people may be moving to East Point or Carabelle, who knows? Or they may be, so those are just some things to think of, whatever you do in terms of that. And here's the other thing, and this is, not making any value judgment here, but in 2000, and I know you can hardly see this, in 2000, the African-American population in the Hill was 81.5%. Today it's 75, so there's a trend that's happening. And believe me, they're aware of that. And I'm not saying anything other than that is something, and that's, I think, part of the concern is just how do we not lose ourselves and identity and all that. And so that's all I wanted to do. So what happened to bring this all about? Well, and I was talking to Mrs. Ford about this, when the thing, and part of this is, particularly in African-American owners, it happened with my grandfather, my great-grandfather, is that they don't leave a will. And so that property goes intestate, or it becomes Harris property. And he had 13 kids like he did. I mean, sometimes I get a hard time getting my son and daughter to agree on things. You can imagine having 13 kids trying to decide on that. And so what happens is it's a big hoo-ha, especially if one ends up paying the property taxes. They think they should have the rights to make all decisions, but they can't because it's all tied up. So if anything, for anybody, and write a will. Leave your property. If you have two or three children, pick one and get the house, and you get my 401k or whatever. Don't leave it to your children to decide. That's really not fair. And it causes a lot of problems. So, and that's why you see a lot of the issues that you have out there in the Hill, some of that, all these properties that are just, there's also a concern that there's just a lack of economic opportunity. And I don't mean to, I'm not trying to put it down. If people don't have jobs, they can't afford a home, can't buy things, and they can't pay property taxes. They can't take care of their property. So all the things that Richard talked about mean nothing if people don't have an economic a job or any kind of thing to really try to make things happen in terms of them. What's going to happen are people who do come in and they can't pay the taxes. I'm going to buy that and miss that. That's why it's important, I think, as we move forward, to think about, and I'll talk a little bit, think about what can the city do in partnership with other entities, private-public partnerships, perhaps, thinking again, talking with Mr. Humphreys and this support is some of the things that they're wanting to do on these properties and help them as an entity do that. that way you keep some legacy involved with that project. But it can all work out if people sit at the table and try to make it work and all that. So again, the problem that happened with the Rhodes property was that very problem. And it benefited, and this is, again, not paying any, it benefited when they went for an auction, people bought it. Fortunately, the property next to Mr. Brown was purchased by my uncle, and so he owns that property. And so, but, so what happens is there's a loss of the value and all that. Again, and that's not to knock anybody, but that's what happens. It's a good piece of property, and it goes for auction, people are going to buy it and take it up. But there's a transfer of property there. This is not a unique problem. There are communities all over in the city that deal with this type of issue. So it's really about finding a solution to really what can really work. I don't know if you have an economic development commission or that you have something that says, what is our long-term viability as a city, as a county, to try to bring jobs, to try to provide some level of economic sustainability for our residents here, not just the poor, but middle class and everyone else. And so people have to do that. What the city of Orlando does, and I know it's a much bigger city for things like that, but just starting through, I think there's a lot of potential here in terms of what I see in the number of tourists. And I'll show you some of that before. The poor will always be with you. You can't get away from the poor. I don't think people should be housed in a high rise. I think people should be offered incentives to own a home, to try to become part of that. I believe in mixed income neighborhoods. And it can work, and it has worked. I'm sure Richard could tell you some of those are places where it has worked. Rentals will always be there. You got to take care of some of those, but so try to think about how you can make those. And I think the other thing is create sustainable and healthy housing opportunities. Look for something that works environmentally, that has amenities that are helpful. I heard someone say they don't like sidewalks. That's fine. I understand that. But when I'm walking my children, I run, I walk. But maybe that's not appropriate for Appalachian Coal. Mm-hmm. And I understand that, but pedestrian friendly neighborhoods are healthy neighborhoods. However you want to do it. So. And you probably can't see this too well, but so this is a. There's a lot of research online, so you can try to. This is an economic breakdown in 2014 and 2015 of the industries in Apalachicola where most of them are occurring. And I wish I could have found more as the years changed, but 2014, 12.4% were in combination and food service. And 2015, it grew to 19.7%. I don't know if that's hospitality, food service, but it seems like tourism is becoming a really good thing to really make it work. And I think you guys know that. And so how can you make that? That's a big thing that's helping to us in Orlando. And we use those tourist tax dollars to help build things, help create CRAs and to establish neighborhoods and build that. It's not just going into one neighborhood, it's going into all the neighborhoods. Infrastructure needs to happen everywhere because people will know when you're not investing in their neighborhood. They know. And so think about how you do that. I don't know if you've ever done a comprehensive neighborhood plan. That's something that we were involved with for Paramore. Now, I'm not a planner. We were a team with a planner, and I'll show you a little bit of some of that. But those things are necessary to really decide how to best grow in that neighborhood. And any planning effort should include the community stakeholders. And I'm talking about the people on the Hill also. They have to be there, and you have to encourage them to be a part of that discussion because it only breeds anxiety, concern, discontent. They're not a part of that discussion. I'm about running out of time, getting there. The restoration of the viable homes that are abandoned is a great thing to do. Sometimes they're challenging. Sometimes you have to ask if you're throwing good money at bad money, but try to make it work. And consider land banking as an option to do that. Yes, sir.
Part of the comments on the mail were that I actually grew up, we also live in the family. But it's very important, I'm working closely with the family and not flip the script and walk the streets as a hometown girl. The Hill is aware of the transformation that's taking place, and a lot of them have indicated that their voices haven't been included. Need to be in the process.
When we, no, you're right. When we did this neighborhood plan in the Paramore area, which is a blighted, historically African American neighborhood, we had community meetings everywhere. People came, and so that's a part of it. Yes, Greg.
What is land banking?
So basically, is municipalities look for vacant or abandoned properties and try to loop them and buy them and purchase them and try to put them in sizable parcels that they can probably sell or develop or encourage as development. So that's really involved in city purchasing and things like that. So real quick in the future, because I'm running out of battery, so I'm going to have to rush through it. This is an area in Orlando called Hampton Park. And I don't have any pictures of what it looked like beforehand, but it was a terrible neighborhood. Really run down, old colleges and all that. They found money from a Hope 6 grant. This part of this was a private partner development. They had a developer come in, and the Orlando Housing Authority required that developer to make sure that 20-25% of those homes went to low-income. This is a mixed neighborhood. And a mixed income neighborhood. Every homeowner here has its own unique character. I would love to live in this neighborhood downtown if I had to. These homes are accelerated in value. And anyone who bought in this neighborhood had to live by deed, had to live there for at least 3 or 4 years. So that's and this is work. So you'd have to go there to kind of appreciate it, but so this can work, and the solution can happen. This may not be appropriate for the Hill, but looking for how you can team and work with those things is very important, and how you can.
Mr. Rhodes, yes. I want to say one thing. Research has shown that impacts children's ability to learn and to be successful in life, and that would be a primary move for our community here because. Our educational opportunities are
an
issue, and it goes from generation to generation, and health is
affected
as well.
Thank you. That's true. So I had two slides left. One was the G word, gentrification, and of course, people can place a value. I know when it first came out, when people started talking about it, it was very negative because I was in New York City a year and a half or 2 years ago. And the big started doing that just pushed it forward everywhere. All the way, they start taking over those homes and pushing everyone out. It doesn't have to have a negative connotation. You can make it work if you have a plan, you get the community involved, you get developers that really work that. And I think that there are some people out there with a vision for this community that have a legacy investment. Legacy in terms of I grew up here, I know how important this is to this community. Can I sit at the table with you? And let's try to make this work for everybody. And that's what I'm saying. And I think that some of those people are very interested in making that happen. So that's really kind of what I wanted to talk to you about and sort of take off my architect hat. And speaking from my heart about how I think this community can really make the Hill a viable place and really help it to grow and sustain itself. And so I'm glad to be able to come talk to you.